Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Catholics in Kenya are mourning the loss of Pope Francis.
He's a simple man down to earth. And who is really imitating Christ, what Christ would have done?
Today we hear more from the African continent where the Catholic Church is growing. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also in Russia, the challenge of measuring public support for the Kremlin.
There is no such thing as support in a non-free society. In order to support something, you have to be able to refuse something.
And the Trump administration's planning a major overhaul of the State Department.
We don't know all the details yet, but it is eliminating 700 positions.
The White House says some offices at state will cease to exist.
We'll also hear about growing food in space and reforestation efforts in Costa Rica.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. Pope Francis was known as the People's Pope. Throughout his papacy, he went out of his way to spend time with poor and marginalized people. As the first Latin American pontiff, he also represented the geographic reach of the church. The Catholic Church has seen a lot of growth in recent decades, especially in sub-Saharan Africa. In one parish in Nairobi, Kenya, people are mourning together.
There are people who are paying a visit to the parish, write down their condolences, where there is a table set outside and a candle lighted in memory of Pope Francis.
That's Father Pascal Mwakio. He's a member of the Youth Advisory Board of the Pan-African Catholic Theology and Pastoral Network. We could hear birds chirping in the late afternoon as he described how local parishioners are remembering Francis.
They are remembering the Pope. And remember, this is the time whereby in the Eucharistic prayers, we don't have the Pope. So the priests are not mentioning the name of any Pope, but they have as their intention to pray for the repose of Francis and also for the success, definitely, of whoever will be elected the next Pope.
You met Pope Francis. What impression did it leave you with to be actually in his presence?
The fatherly figure, one who is there for everybody, one who would want to ensure that whoever comes to pray at the St. Peter's Square for a pilgrimage or who is studying there has that opportunity just to greet him or say hello in that simplicity, remembering the very first words when he appeared to speak to the world after his election. He used simple language, good evening, buona sera, and after buona notte, which was not the language people were used to. They shifted from the tradition to be simple to the world, and that's who Pope Francis is. He shows that he's a simple man down to earth, and who is really imitating Christ, what Christ would have done.
So Francis visited Kenya in 2015, not long after becoming pope. He also visited Africa five other times and went to 10 different countries on the continent. I mean, what does that tell us about how Catholicism has kind of touched the African continent and Francis's role in that?
Definitely, it shows that Catholicism has kept on growing, and we cannot ignore the fact that there are about 54 so countries in Africa, and the Catholics there, it is in an increasing trajectory. The vocations are booming in terms of religious vocations, the number of Catholics themselves, and all to it all we can say it is also contributed to the fact that we have also a high birth rate as compared to other parts of the world.
Looking at statistics, it seems that Africa is home to around 300 million Catholics, the fastest growing region for the church in the world. What would you say has been the relationship and the growth of that relationship between Pope Francis and the continent?
First of all, I would say that in his 12-year term, he made sure that the church participates from
the local churches themselves. He made sure that there is inclusion, there is participation. He's considered a pope for the people in the sense that he minds about those of the existential peripheries, the poor, the very much needy, those who are almost neglected. That by itself associates with the third world countries, the so-called third world countries, of which Kenya and many other parts of Africa are part of it.
Father, you actually coordinate the Church's African Digital Missionaries, which is an initiative that came through Pope Francis. Tell us more about that.
Yes. Pope Francis mentioned about reaching those who are far at the peripheries, and amongst them were those on the digital space. There are a number of youths who, in the digital space, some of them who are not closer to the church, but they find themselves on the digital space. How can we include them? How can they be also evangelized? And it went on increasing up to an outreach of almost every African country represented, having the youths gather together in various online groups, digital groups, from which Pope Francis, of course, encouraged the youths to build bridges. The youths as the church of now.
That seems like a really significant change in missionary work. I mean, how much has that digital approach accelerated the growth of the church in Africa in a way that perhaps brick and mortar missionary work on the ground was unable to?
Yeah, definitely. We are able to connect with youths from across Africa. Most of them we have never met in person, and it is only virtually that we are meeting. So if I have to travel to Uganda or to Nigeria, to Senegal, to Congo, and anywhere else, there are people I know there. In case somebody needs anything, we share experiences amongst ourselves, what is taking place in the church, on the ground. So it has made things easier.
I just want to return to Pope Francis as we await his funeral on Saturday. I'm curious, there in Nairobi, how are people talking about the succession to Pope Francis?
Of course, everybody is eager to know who will be the next pope.
There must be a lot of anticipation and hope, perhaps, because Pope Francis, the first pope from Latin America, the last Catholic pope believed to be born in Africa, lived more than 1,500 years ago. So is there a conversation about, will the next pope be from the continent?
Yes, and I am sure through reading the signs of the times, reflecting about synodality, about participation, about inclusion, the Pope can be elected from any part of the world, and especially where we have not had really black Pope from an African country, apart from the Northern African countries, who were mainly the three Popes which we had. So it is my wish that they would consider Africa as among those, or the Asian countries among those who they can get the Pope from.
That's Father Pascal Mwakio, a Catholic priest in Nairobi, Kenya. He's a member of the Youth Advisory Board of the Pan-African Catholic Theology and Pastoral Network. A funeral mass for Pope Francis is planned for Saturday in the square outside St. Peter's Basilica at the Vatican in Rome. World leaders from all over are expected to be in attendance, along with a crowd of tens of thousands of mourners. The public will be able to pay its respects starting tomorrow morning, when Francis's coffin will be taken from the chapel where he had his living quarters to the basilica where the late pope will lie in state. Stay with the world for more coverage in the coming days.
Vladimir Putin signaled yesterday that he is open to speaking directly with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. This is something new for the Russian leader. Putin said he hopes that Ukraine is open to talking peace as well. Experts say it is not clear how serious he really is. It's also difficult to gauge what Russians think about Putin's leadership or about the war. As the world's Daniel Offman reports, getting a handle on public opinion in Russia comes with unique challenges.
There's a famous quote about Russia attributed to who else but Winston Churchill. He said, "I cannot forecast to you the action of Russia. It is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma." For more than 80 years, that quote has been used and overused to indicate that it's hard to understand Russia, its people, and its government. Ekaterina Shulman, a Berlin-based political scientist with the Carnegie Center, dispels this notion.
We Russians tend to see ourselves as very unique, but we are a very banal, personalized autocracy, the likes of which are spread over the face of the earth.
Schulman says that a personalized autocracy is a very primitive form of government where all the power is held by a single leader. This is how she describes it.
Ineffective, incompetent, unworthy governance. The governance that is not too clever, not too effective, manifestly corrupt, and invests all its resources to stay in power. There's nothing more ordinary than that.
One of the hallmarks of this kind of autocratic government is making it harder to gauge public opinion, especially with limited access to data that's not generated by the government.
We can still study Russia. Yes, we can. It is not impossible, but of course, no question, it has become a much more challenging task.
That's Maria Lippmann, a visiting researcher at George Washington University and an expert Russia analyst. She says there's been a debate around the study of public opinion in Russia, especially since the invasion, now that public dissent against Russia's war can lead to criminal charges.
The obvious objection, those who call such studies in question say that how do you expect a person give a sincere answer to the question of do you support the Russian special military operation, of course, the way the war is referred to in Russia, and how do you expect people to tell you the truth?
That concern is called preference falsification, and it's a common problem that sociologists confront when people publicly misrepresent what they think privately. But Lippmann says that dismissing all survey results representing Russian public opinion would be a mistake. Margarita Zavadska, a senior researcher at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs, agrees.
The problem now, we're basically forced to sort of develop alternative workarounds using, again, digital methodologies to sort of compensate for the lack of this firsthand experience.
For researchers based outside of Russia, instead of in-person surveys and focus groups, much more work is done online. Zavadska says that analysis becomes even more important when looking at polling data coming from authoritarian countries.
Since these data are generated from non-democratic contexts, it has to be taken into account when one interprets the results. Interpretation is the key. So how do we approach the very nature of political support in this country?
For example, according to a poll conducted last month by the Levada Center, a non-governmental research organization in Russia, 79% of respondents said they supported the actions of Russian military forces in Ukraine. At the same time, nearly 60% of respondents supported peace negotiations. Ekaterina Schulman says these kinds of results are significant, but certain aspects can't be taken at face value.
There is no such thing as support in a non-free society. In order to support something, you have to be able to refuse something. And if you don't have that option, your support means nothing.
Schulman says that you can still glean a lot of information from these kinds of studies that tell us about what she calls demonstrative loyalty. Loyalty that shows what's socially acceptable, but it's brittle and can fall apart very quickly.
The degree of loyalty can be measured, and it is important because power stands in power as long as people believe that it is power. We have seen time and again in many autocracies how they collapse overnight because suddenly people understand that the power has weakened.
Schulman says pinpointing that exact moment is beyond what political scientists can do. But she says that studying the Russian government and its people, even from outside the country, is neither a riddle, nor a mystery, nor an enigma. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
At least 20 people were killed and dozens more injured in Indian-controlled Kashmir today. A group of gunmen opened fire at a resort there in a mass shooting. Most of the victims were Indian tourists.
Local police described the shooting as a terror attack carried out by separatists opposed to Indian control over Kashmir. No one claimed immediate responsibility for the attack. The region's top elected official, Omar Abdullah, wrote on social media that this attack is much larger than anything we've seen directed at civilians in recent years.
The shooting coincides with a visit to India by Vice President J.D. Vance, who expressed his condolences in an online post.
Hey, this is David Rind. I'm an audio producer at CNN. And one of my favorite things about working at CNN is that I can call up our super smart correspondents and reporters whenever I want to pick their brains about the news and the stories they're covering. Well, I want to bring you in on those conversations with our podcast, CNN One Thing. Each week, I grab one of those said reporters and we break down one big story that's been making headlines. Again, the podcast is CNN One Thing. Listen on your favorite podcast app.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Two powerful earthquakes hit Myanmar in late March, and the country faces conditions that allow waterborne diseases like cholera to spread. It's not clear how the country, still in a civil war, will be able to manage a disease outbreak. Damien Blanc is a water sanitation expert for the European Union's humanitarian aid response in Myanmar. He's based in Bangkok.
We had 3.5 million people already internally displaced due to the ongoing conflict in Myanmar. And we had 200,000 more people who were displaced because of the earthquake. So it's a crisis within a crisis that was already pretty much underfunded. The UN data, for instance, shows that the crisis there was basically 5% of the needs were just covered. And on top of that, just linked to the civil war. On top of that, you have the earthquakes that creates even more suffering and more affected people.
Damien, I know you're planning a trip to Myanmar in the coming days. Do you have any sense of what it looks like on the ground for people who are living, you know, with disrupted infrastructure, with wastewater problems in these heavy rains? What does that mean for day-to-day life?
Well, what I fear to see is people under very basic shelters, not necessarily completely safe from the weather outside. And now the weather is, when it's not showering rains, it's super, super hot. So you can imagine the conditions. And on top of that, they've lost also access to other basic facilities of services, such as access to water, even worse, access to sanitation, which will trigger a huge risk of epidemics, as you mentioned it in your introduction.
You say there's a risk of waterborne diseases like cholera that I mentioned. What are we seeing so far in terms of numbers of these diseases?
What I can tell you, for instance, is that there were almost more than 700 cases of what they call over there acute watery diarrhea, because it's not reported as cholera. But basically, that's what we suspect being cholera. There was more than 700 cases between January and February this year. So you know that the disease is rampant in the area. That includes Mandalay. That was one of the most affected areas by the earthquake. And so you know that people have lost access to sanitation. So there's a lot of open defecation going on. So with a disease that is prone to spread with poor sanitation, we are fearing that it might explode and all over the places. That's what we're pretty much concerned of.
Right now, just how much are people depending on aid from outside the country to meet their basic needs?
Before the crisis, we were talking about 19.9 million people. So that's a third of the population of Myanmar. So imagine you're walking in Los Angeles and one person out of two lacks food, one out of two does not have access to safe water. This is the picture you would get in order for you to give you an idea of what it means. And the third of the country, that includes 6 million children also that are in need of humanitarian aid before the earthquake. So you can imagine that as of now, there was population that were already suffering and that's now having to deal with additional sufferings.
Damien Blanc is a water sanitation expert who's part of the European Union's response in Myanmar.
If you've seen the film The Martian, you might remember how Matt Damon's character, an astronaut left behind on Mars, figures out how to grow potatoes.
It's been 48 sols since I planted the potatoes, so now it's time to reap and re-sow. They grew even better than I expected. I now have 400 healthy potato plants.
In real life, if humans want to make food in space, they're going to have to take the technology with them. And today, the European Space Agency took the first step. It sent a mini food lab known as a bioreactor into space aboard a SpaceX rocket for a three-hour flight. The goal is to have a working food production plant on the International Space Station within several years. Akhil Shamsul is the CEO of Frontier Space, a British biotech company that is one of the partners in this effort. I asked him to describe the bioreactor.
The way I view it is it's like a cooking pot or an oven. Fundamentally, what you do is you put your microbes in there, you put them in a nice controlled environment. Essentially, it's a growing vessel for microbes. So let's say we have a yeast, for example. We put them in a bioreactor, bring it into space, we grow them, and then the yeast will produce proteins that we want to use for our application. And this could be from biomaterial, pharmaceutical, or fuel.
The rocket was in space for 3 hours. Now it's back down on Earth. When you examine the returned bioreactor, what are you going to be looking for?
There will be some influence in terms of the environment it endured, going up, going down, and even though the small time frame of microgravity. Fundamentally, what we will do is we will bring it back down, bring the sample to Imperial, and Imperial will do a lot of post-analysis, just trying to understand how does the biology experience, and can we still grow them after all of this journey.
You mentioned Imperial. That's Imperial College in London, which you're collaborating with. Yeah. So let's scale back any kind of hopes that you'll send this bioreactor up in space and you'll come back with a steak. I mean, how far away is that concept?
Yeah, so it depends on how much funding goes into this development. The technology that we're developing now is a smaller scale bioreactor. And what we're trying to do is trying to get a larger scale within a 2 years timeline. This allows us to grow the larger proteins, but there's one or two steps after that. Is that how do we extract the proteins? How do we then powderize them to make them into, I don't know, steak using a 3D bioprinter, for example?
Do the basic facts of being in space limit what you'll actually be able to grow in a space-based lab?
Yeah, so I mean, this is something that is the next frontier, right? I think there's a lot of study that still needs to be done in space environment, but the idea of using synthetic biology to produce specific protein is something relatively new. There will be some impact of microgravity in terms of growing the microbes, but there's also been studies showing that they can actually aggregate and yield better production. So there's still sort of uncharted territory that we need to navigate.
Yeah, and with the ISS, the International Space Station, I mean, you've got a lot of different food cultures to address. Mm-hmm. The food's got to be appetizing and taste good, whether you're in outer space or not. How are you going about creating tasty food?
Again, this is very important, right? I think for morale, just having a nice food that someone can relate, it's extremely important. So the benefit of actually using this kind of precision fermentation is that we can actually cultivate flavor profile compounds, for example. So we can actually make Indian cuisine, Chinese cuisine, to be able to really just produce that food that we can relate to for morale purposes.
Would it be possible to build a platform for growing food in space that could reside in the International Space Station? Or would it be somehow like attached to it, like almost like a greenhouse?
Yeah, so in a short sense, yes. For the International Space Station, however, I mean, one of the issues that we're facing is that it is currently due to be decommissioned within 5 years. So we need to start thinking about how we can integrate this to the newer infrastructure that's coming up.
I'm wondering, Akhil, if when you get to the food kind of proof of concept and it's at scale, are you going to be an official taste tester?
It's a good question. I don't know if you've seen the news piece. So BBC was covering this and we actually did a taste test where the chef did a dumpling. The flavor is there. Obviously, there's still some things that need to be fixed, but it's not off-putting. It can actually be quite a nice, tasty meal.
What kind of dumpling was it?
Oof, it was basically ground up yeast put into a dumpling shell. Ginger taste.
Mm.
Yeah.
Even in space, they say bon appetit. Akhil Shamsul is the CEO of Frontier Space, a British biotech company that's part of the European Space Agency's project aiming to make food in space.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Nova Scotia, one startup is pumping a bright pink mineral slurry into the ocean. Off the coast of North Carolina, another is doing something similar with mineral-rich sand. And in Singapore, there's a company trying to suck up seawater and run electric currents through it. Dozens of projects like this have launched in the last few years, all aiming to increase the amount of carbon dioxide that the ocean can store. There's been a swell of interest in this field of marine geoengineering. It is also highly controversial. Scientists say it is not clear what the long-term impacts of tinkering with the ocean would be. We're looking at this as part of our ongoing series on climate solutions, The Big Fix. Susanna Liedstrom studies the history of marine science and policy at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden.
The ocean, it's so vast and the volumes of waters are so big. And that the ocean can hold a lot more carbon dioxide than the atmosphere. So basically, the idea is to enhance the ocean's ability to take up carbon dioxide and thereby lower the levels of carbon in the atmosphere.
I've named a few examples, but what are the major kinds of projects we are seeing that are being tested around the world right now?
Yeah, so basically there are a few different approaches. One is that you add material to the ocean that increases the ocean's production of organic matter. So you can do this through adding iron to the ocean, or you can add other alkaline materials that increases the ocean's uptake of carbon. You can also sink organic matter that you take either from the ocean in the form of algae or from land such as wood chips, and you just sink all this matter to the bottom of the ocean. You can also extract carbon directly from the seawater through chemical processes, and then paired then with this idea that it will be possible to then store the carbon that you sort of collect at the bottom of the ocean.
How much evidence is there that that actually works?
I mean, it's hard to say exactly, because you can, you know, you can demonstrate, you know, a chemical reaction that works. You can do this. But I mean, none of these technologies have been demonstrated at scale. And then, of course, once you move to scale, there are so many unknown unknowns, so to speak. So obviously, if you sink a lot of organic matter to the seafloor, you will smother all the life that lives there. If you add a lot of particles to the water column, that will affect all the organisms that live there. You know, in worst case scenario, you will disturb the existing cycles that take up carbon from the atmosphere and store it in the ocean. But then there are a lot of social concerns as well. I mean, the people who are driving these ideas are basically private actors who are looking to benefit. There's no governance of these activities. There's also no mechanism to monitor what's going on. There's a high risk that you do experiments in a place where the local and the regional environment and the people who live there may suffer from impacts on fisheries and other things.
So there are a lot of concerns, even if these projects could be scaled up to an effective size. But lots of new projects are being launched. There are some governments that are backing experiments into this approach. There are carbon credits that are already financing some of these projects. And there's money from accelerators and things like that. So why is there this big increase in interest in this idea right now, if it is still very early stages and as yet unproven?
I think the main reason is, you know, people are getting increasingly desperate as, you know, we're failing to lower emissions significantly. People are looking for other ways to address the climate crisis. But I think if you take a more holistic view of all the other environmental crises that are ongoing as well, like biodiversity loss and the state of the ocean, the argument for marine carbon dioxide removal becomes much weaker.
This, as I've mentioned, is a controversial idea. Are there scientists who don't have an active stake in one of these companies doing this that would disagree with what you just said? That, you know, we have not reduced carbon emissions, and so we do need to explore other possibilities for removing carbon from the atmosphere?
Yes, I mean, scientists are just people, and they have a lot of different opinions about this. I wouldn't say that there's any consensus among the scientific community. People have a lot of different opinions, but I think the one thing that most scientists would agree on is that a lot more research is needed and a lot more governance frameworks are needed.
So what would it take for this to become a meaningful climate solution? Or maybe what would it take for you to be convinced that this could be or has become a meaningful climate solution?
One of my main concerns at the moment is that not much is said about the final storing of the carbon. That's just kind of, often it's just added as, you know, a footnote or something that we will then store this in the deep ocean, as if that's a place that you can just store things and that doesn't have, you know, life.
So where exactly is all this carbon going to be sequestered?
Exactly. Where is it going to go? You know, the estimates are that you can store this carbon from like as little as 50 years. And I mean, if we can't store it for a longer time than that, it's just not meaningful.
Susanna Liedstrom is a visiting researcher this year at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in California.
Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, is going on trial soon. He's charged with leading an attempted coup after losing the election in Brazil in 2022. A panel of judges on Brazil's Supreme Court began proceedings this morning to determine whether police officials, retired military officers, and a Bolsonaro aide will also stand trial.
When the prosecutor general accused Bolsonaro and 33 others of attempting a coup, he divided them into five different groups based on their roles in the alleged plot. Bolsonaro and his closest allies were placed in a so-called core group. Last month, the panel of judges unanimously accepted those charges and ordered the former president to stand trial.
Now the Supreme Court is reviewing charges against a second group. Bolsonaro is expected to go on trial in the next few months. He and his allies have repeatedly denied wrongdoing. Search for the phrase heart-healthy diet, and it's likely you'll get recipes for green smoothies, grilled fish, and Greek salad. Sounds good, and it's good for you. But experts say it's time to expand the idea of what healthy eating looks like and take some cues from non-Western countries. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
About 6 months ago, I found out I had high cholesterol, so I went to a nutritionist, and she gave me these handouts, you know, like sample meal plans. There was a picture of overnight oats, a recipe for skinny shrimp scampi, and other kind of Mediterranean diet staples. Tamara Melton knows these handouts well.
Brown rice, chicken breasts, and broccoli, like the most bland meal that is on a plate. It was always some variation of that.
She's a registered dietitian in Atlanta.
Which you're not going to see anything in there about like chana masala or roti, which is what I grew up eating.
Melton is part Trinidadian.
But yes, there is definitely an absence of different cultures' ingredients and then the recipes themselves and the meals themselves. And that's what we were taught to show to people.
Part of it comes down to an information gap. There's limited data on the immune and metabolic impacts of Latin American, Asian, and African diets, especially compared to the mountains of data on the Mediterranean diet. Dr. Godfrey Temba at KCMC University in Moshi, Tanzania, is trying to change that. He studies the eating habits of rural communities in Tanzania's Kilimanjaro region.
Many people in the rural areas eat like plantain. So plantain, this is a green banana. So they cook plantain together with beans, like kidney beans, and this can be served with avocado and some green vegetables.
The dish is called kiburu in the local language. They also drink a beer called mbege, made from ripe bananas and sprouted millet powder. Temba says what surprised him when he visited these villages is that he would meet people well into their 90s, and they were vibrant and energetic and with it.
And they often like rise up at the dawn, they walk to their farms, to the local market, they have their home gardens. They remain very active.
What's their secret? Mbege. Temba's latest study followed a group of 77 men in their 20s and 30s, roughly half from a village and half from a city where the diet is mainly Western food. For 2 weeks, villagers had to eat city food and the city folk had to eat village food. And Temba's team took blood samples along the way. Their results are published this month in the journal Nature Medicine. They found that switching to the traditional African diet for just 2 weeks resulted in sustained improvements to the body's immune system.
You see the immune function, like the markers of inflammation, is going down. You see the ability of the immune cells to fight the infections. It's improved. But also we see the markers of the cardiovascular diseases. They're also going down.
Now, this study is small and the cohort is limited. Still, Temba says the insights from it can inform nutritional guidelines all over the world.
For too long now, the global health has followed a one-way street. Like research conducted in the high-income countries, lead to recommendations that may not translate well to the African context. But what our study demonstrates is that the opposite flow, like south to north, knowledge transfer, is also equally vital.
Speaking of, so I'm in my local Whole Foods, and there is a row of plantains, like just a few. They're a little sad at the end of the bananas. No cassava, though, I don't think. No cassava. But here is a whole bunch of olives and feta. So it looks like, for now, to control my cholesterol, I'm stuck with the Mediterranean diet. But hopefully it won't be that way forever. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Today, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced the first phase of a major restructuring of the State Department. The reshuffle consolidates departments, slashes budgets, and eliminates staff. Rubio says the redesign addresses what he called decades of bloat and bureaucracy. The details of the plan are not out yet, but it's already getting stiff criticism from people who know how the State Department works. That includes former Ambassador Wendy Sherman. She was second in command at the State Department from 2021 to 2023.
We don't know all the details yet, but what Rubio is suggesting is taking 734 offices down to 602, a 17% decrease, to decrease U.S.-based employees by 15%, to cut 700 positions in the first instance beyond asking for an additional 15%, and really getting rid of some offices that represent America's values, like looking after human rights and war crimes and global conflicts. So it's pretty significant.
So the reshuffle includes the creation of at least one new entity, the Bureau of Emerging Threats, that would focus on cybersecurity. It does sound like it needs more details, but it also sounds like it's something the Department of Defense might oversee. Is it clear how this State Department 2.0 is going to operate in tandem with other government departments that are also being cut?
Oh, not at all, Marco. I think one of the things that is so disturbing about President Trump's approach is that it's creating chaos without a plan. And we can see what happens when there are no really detailed plans, when there is no consideration. The administration makes many mistakes and errors, fires people and has to rehire them, tries to get things done, but don't have the experts or personnel to do it. And so there's a great cost. Everybody wants more government efficiency. Everybody has looked at a reorganization plan for the State Department, every single Secretary of State. But we have to represent the vast array of interests of the United States. We have to represent our values. And we have to really value the expertise of our civil servants and our foreign service. These are folks who come with specific capabilities. It allows us to be incredibly powerful in negotiations because we have the deepest and most expert bench every time we sit at a table.
Well, this reshuffle is being described as a bid for efficiency and cost cutting. When you were undersecretary, did you see inefficiency in the bureaucracy, things that could or should have been done better?
Well, certainly. I've worked for five secretaries of state and three presidents, and every single one of us have seen things that we would like to streamline, make more efficient, have more flexibility in how we approach things. Sometimes Congress has given us that flexibility. Sometimes Congress has mandated offices, and the State Department has no choice but to proceed forward. It's so startling because Secretary Rubio, when he was a senator, was an enormous advocate for human rights and democracy, given his Cuban roots, given what his own family had gone through to be able to leave Cuba, to come to a democratic country and fight for democracy. And now he's really subsuming a lot of those values in the face of what the president has asked for.
As you said, most every incoming administration makes organizational changes. When the changes appear this broad, though, can you help us understand the basic day-to-day practical adjustments that this revamp of the State Department will have on its employees in Washington and around the globe?
Well, I would say, Marco, that employees at the State Department are already feeling very vulnerable, very scared, very nervous. Senior Foreign Service officers who have years of valuable expertise, many have considered and already have retired rather than face the uncertainty of what's in front of us. Civil servants don't know whether they're going to have jobs day to day. So now they are faced with a potentially vast reorganization. They don't know where they'll be working. There will be uncertainty for some time to come because the reorganization plans aren't due until July 1. Things have to go through the congressional process of review and budgeting. And so people live with uncertainty, which means they don't do their jobs with confidence that there is support for what they are trying to accomplish. It's a very scary time for people.
Ambassador, as you said, this plan has to go to Congress. What sort of authority does Congress actually have over these proposed changes?
Well, some of them, Congress has a great deal of authority. They certainly have authority when it comes to the appropriations in terms of cutting the budget, cutting the caps on the number of offices, the number of undersecretaries. They have authority on some particular offices which are mandated by Congress. And so, therefore, Congress will have to approve changing those mandates. So there's an awful lot of legal work to be done here, a lot of work to be done to see whether Congress can just wholesale take on this reorganization. I suspect there will be some changes. But again, this is a Republican-controlled Congress, a MAGA-controlled Congress. So far, they have pretty much saluted whatever the president has asked for, much to my personal dismay.
Former Ambassador Wendy Sherman, she served as Deputy Secretary at the State Department from 2021 to 2023.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Healthy forests are essential for a healthy planet. We have known that to be true for a long time. But scientists are just starting to get a handle on the complex interactions between everything that lives in a forest and even how many trees they contain. That is the focus of a new PBS documentary called Secrets of the Forest, featuring British ecologist Thomas Crowther.
We were pretty astonished to find that we're not talking about millions or billions. There was actually 3 trillion trees on the planet. And that blew our minds. It was, you know, this first glimpse into the immense scale of this system.
Much work is being done to restore forests that have been cleared. That is part of what Rebecca Cole talks about in the documentary. She is a restoration ecologist in Costa Rica. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you talk in this documentary about your personal connection with Costa Rica's forests from when you were growing up and what motivated you to do this work. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think my motivation for this work started when I was really quite young. I grew up on what was then the rainforest frontier of southern Costa Rica. My parents were some of the earlier settlers to the Cotabruz region. I have to say, of course, indigenous people had lived in that area for thousands of years, but the impact of the modern settler was much more drastic with large-scale clearing, intensive agriculture, and much more rapid ecological change. And so as a young person, I got to witness this change of a vibrant living landscape transformed into something that was much more heavily damaged and depleted. Mm. And I think actually seeing that transition is what pulled me into restoration.
So what did it look like when you were very little, maybe? And then what did it look like after those changes had really taken effect? I mean, are there animals or plants that used to be part of your daily life that then no longer were?
Yeah. So when I was really young, we lived on a farm. My family had a small farm. And it was very much surrounded by forest, and interactions with the wildlife were just part of our everyday. As time went on, that forest was cleared. I remember looking up at this small mountain range, and within a couple of years, that mountain range that had been completely forested was completely deforested. Wow. We could then, you know, see our neighbor's property where there was forest. It got transformed either into coffee plantations or pasture. So really very drastic change over a short time.
Were there any animals that disappeared?
There were many animals that disappeared. So the first ones to go were the larger animals like peccaries and deer and tapirs and big cats that were completely hunted out or just didn't have enough habitat. Then over time, we noticed that other smaller animals like birds, some bird species became much more rare. And there were plants that we didn't see as frequently or maybe completely disappeared.
So the story of the forest in Costa Rica has changed since then. It is heralded as a success story, especially a success story in the tropics regarding reforestation. What was kind of the low point? When was forest cover its lowest? And what has happened since then?
Yeah, in the early 1980s, forest cover in Costa Rica dropped to about 25% due to obviously forest clearing, land conversion for agriculture, and particularly cattle grazing. And around that time, the country started adopting some really forward-thinking conservation policies, including a launch of payments for environmental services program in the mid-1990s. And this incentivized landowners to protect and restore forests. So I think those efforts, along with some other economic and cultural factors, have been really highly successful, and forest cover is now back up around 50%, which is really remarkable.
That 25%, is that 25% of the whole area of the country or 25% of the forests that used to be there?
That was 25% of the forests that used to be there.
Okay. And so now about half of the forests that used to be in Costa Rica exist.
Right. Exactly.
And so you are responsible for a small part of that reforestation. What does your work look like in restoring some of these ecosystems?
Right. So my work is responsible for a very small part of that. In addition to being a scientist, I'm also a practitioner. So I'm restoring forest on my own land. That involves a lot of boots on the ground work, working with native tree species and figuring out what will grow in degraded lands. And then beyond that, I also work with a network of about 50 NGOs across Latin America who are helping to test new methods to restore forest on degraded lands.
Mm. One of the big themes that this documentary hits on is that it's not just about planting trees or maybe, you know, the same type of tree just covering a whole area. Forest ecosystems are much more complex than that. You need a lot of diversity for thriving ecosystems. So what are some of the things you think about when you're trying to restore forests in Costa Rica?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not just about planting trees, right? We're trying to recover whole ecosystems and their functionality. So in my work, I'm thinking about restoring soils with their complement of biota and biodiversity. We're thinking about the animal species that disperse seeds so that plants can continue to regenerate. And so it's very much a whole ecosystem approach.
Mm. So on your own farm, I understand you still own the farm that you grew up on. Is that right?
That's right.
You mentioned the hillside or the mountains that you could see from there had been deforested, and then some of the animals had disappeared, the tapirs, big cats, things like that. What's the situation now? Are there forests on those mountains near your land now?
There are some patches. I'm working with a variety of different NGOs to help farmers put trees back in areas where, you know, it's beneficial to their farm plans to do that. But I can still look up at those hills and see landslides and barren areas that don't serve as pasture for agriculture at this point. So there's still quite a bit of work ahead, but the trend is going in the right direction. And we're seeing a lot of landowners just really becoming engaged and just realizing that they need to manage their lands in a better way.
So lots of work has been done, but there's a lot to do still.
Exactly.
That's Rebecca Cole. She's the director of Costa Rica's Loma Linda Field Station. She appears in the new PBS documentary from our colleagues at NOVA called Secrets of the Forest. You can stream it now on YouTube.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.